Session number 9278, Stafford Cotman, part 6.
And Fred Coatman was complaining about it for other sort of reasons, because there were a lot of disillusioned members of the International Brigade, and some of their disenchantment was made up of these sort of things.
Now, did you go and leave specifically for May Day in Barcelona?
Oh, no. No, it was just due. So, you know, the contingent was just due for it to leave anyway.
Was it the whole of the contingent
went
on leave?
Yes, mostly. I think a few were left, and a few were coming on afterwards. But I think they all got there during May Day, and then there was some period before some went back. I don't think they all went back together.
Well, when did you first become aware of the disturbances in Barcelona?
Oh, I was there. Oh, well, we always had this war and revolution thing, but it never came to anything. There was a lot of reports in papers about this sort of situation can't go on and things will come to a head and these matters cannot stay resolved, this kind of thing going on in practically everybody's papers. So it didn't come as any surprise. But when shots were heard and it was obvious that some fighting was going on somewhere, we reported back to the PUM headquarters and said, well, what's happening? We're here at your service, sort of thing.
Which day would that have been?
This was May the 3rd.
That you went to PUM headquarters?
Yeah, yes. Practically everybody seemed to do the same thing. They were drinking beer, wearing cafes in different places, and they all seemed to go back to the headquarters. I think not all of them did, not all of them could. Some of them were stuck in their hotels and they didn't like the idea of going to the PUM headquarters because they felt they would be committed and they weren't sure that they wanted to be committed. And this is very funny, really, because this chap Thompson in the hotel that didn't report the PUM headquarters said, well, we're going to be here for a bit. Let's get some beer in. So a couple went out and got a lot of bottles of beer to sort of drink in the hotel while the lunacy raved outside, you see. And the police were not pleased with the fact that they were taking all this beer back, whether they thought that it could lead to rioting, or they might get drunk, or that it wasn't a good start. Anyway, they arrested them and took them to prison as being a danger and likely to be a sort of breach of the peace thing with this beer and all that business.
Took who in? Thompson and...
And then a couple of the others. I've forgotten who the others were. So they decided to keep out of it and were unwittingly drawn into it because they went and got a lot of beer and they happened to come against a bloke that thought, well, beer drinking is hardly the thing at this particular moment. And there was too much beer there for their safety.
So when you went to the PUM headquarters, what time of day was that?
Oh, about mid-morning, I think.
And was there a great mass of people there?
Well, for a time, it did become not a mass, but quite a lot of people did come. But the streets were sort of alternately moving with some people and then deserted and then quiet, I suppose because of the uncertainty. In the square, just at the end of the Ramblas, there was actual fighting and firing going on. And the attackers that were going for the building were being backed up by other people. And on the fringe of the bit of around the telephone building were the defenders that were trying to keep them off. And we were just sort of on the end, adjacent, probably is the word, to the two. So that if you got too close to that end, you were likely to be shot in the firing line. So you kept away from it, and you kept out of the middle of the road in particular, because, you know, you could shelter in shop doorways a lot easier. When we got to the Pullman quarters, people were coming and going, but a lot of us stayed there. I slept there on the roofs with my blasted bombs for 3 nights, I think, until it finished, and which it just petered out. They got the building, and once they got the building, I think a truce was arrived at. And I don't think the communists wanted to carry the attack any further, because the resistance was greater than they thought. And the resistors didn't want to perpetuate the fighting, because it wasn't any good for morale or the war effort. So it just came to an end. And they had got the telephone building.
Did you see the surrender at the telephone building?
Oh, no. I just heard about it. I don't think there was any sort of official. They just occupied the jobs. And they put different operators and people in. And the anarcho-syndicalists, who didn't like it because they had occupied the building and now were no longer allowed to, and having some people having been shot for it, it wasn't such a... I think there were, I believe, less than 100 casualties.
Did you see any casualties?
Yes, I did. I saw blokes carried away in stretchers and things like that, sure.
From the besiegers?
Sorry?
From the besiegers.
Yes. I remember a Spaniard who really had got to Poom early and reported, and they sent him to the telephone building to back up the anarchists. He had terrible damage, kidneys and things like this. And I went to see him in hospital, and he was now, because of the extent of his injuries, convinced of the absolute folly of war. And he said, "Go home, Stafford, go home, take all your English people home. This is futile and ridiculous and silly, and there's never any sense in it." It's funny how you get pacifist views at a time when you'd least expect them. Among other people I met in Barcelona was, of all people, Willy Brandt, who was there reporting for his newspaper, an underground German newspaper, and he was very much pacifist inclined. And it was he who made me feel a bit guilty in a way. He said, "You realise that we are not up against fascists, we're not up against the Hitler Mussolini type supporters whom we hate so much. We are up against ordinary Spanish kids conscripted by Franco." And put that way, you don't have such a strong appetite for the war, because, you know, there you are, some ordinary Spanish bloke who's victim of the situation. If you could be up against some army officer, a dedicated fascist, there might be more point in it.
What impression did you get of Willy Brandt?
I very good impression, very honest, as indeed, you see, to say that at a time when most of us were advocating war fever, needed a very honest mind, because he made me and some of the rest of us feel a bit uncomfortable, because there we are out there fighting fascism, and we're told, "No, you're not fighting fascism, you're fighting some kids at a call up by Franco."
How long did you meet him for?
Oh, he was there off and on. you know, we met each other for drinks in groups like you do. And I don't know, I must have met him half a dozen times, but very often with John McNair, because John, being the sort of administrator for the ILP volunteer group, was frequently in his company.
Coming back to the Barcelona disturbance,
yes.
Was the POUM headquarters attacked?
No. No, they let it alone entirely.
Was there any shooting from the POUM headquarters?
I didn't see any, and I don't think there was. Which made the allegations that it was started by the POUM and a POUM uprising, and the POUM Trotskyist uprising, as it was often described as by political commentators who wanted to be favourable to the communists. It was complicated in many ways, because the communists, the Russians, were giving some or supplying some arms to Spain, you see, and part of the penalty for that was to get their own way in political matters. It wasn't that they were sold, in fact. The Russians didn't give the Spanish government arms. It was a commercial undertaking. And along with this was the things like getting chaps like Salas to attack buildings, just getting, I think, the chief of police at Tarragona to appoint men approved of by communists. All this sort of thing was going on. And we didn't have the chapter and verse and detail of it then, and probably a lot of it we wouldn't have now. I was mentioning, I think, perhaps we weren't on tape, but I was mentioning Andrews Nin, whose life had been threatened, and we knew it had been threatened, and then we knew he disappeared, and then they found his body. But we still didn't know the circumstances of it, and I didn't have much more to do with it until, I think it was 1968, I read Robert Conquest's book on it, and Orlov, who had defected from the Soviet Union, gives names of the people that were responsible for the Nin assassination. This shows you how in history you sometimes have to wait a long, long time before you got to the truth. And then it came from such a surprising source as that. And but for the Orlov defection, we still wouldn't really have much proof of the connection that the secret police, the Russian secret police, had influencing the Spanish Civil War. It's important to make the distinction between the Russian secret police and the Communist Party. The two are not anything like the same, and I don't suppose the Spanish communists knew anything about these sort of dirty tricks.
Now, you mentioned Nin. I think you said that you actually met him
in
Spain.
Yes.
Can you tell me about when and under what circumstances?
Yes, he worked with McNair at the POUM headquarters, and he used to send articles, I think, mainly to France, but some to America, and I think South America, different places like this, informing them of what was happening in Spain. And I suppose because of the political acuteness of the man, that he would be reporting things which otherwise wouldn't have been reported. And so he must have been important enough for the Russian secret police not to have him say the things and write the things that he was writing.
So when
they blackened him as a Trotskyist, as they did us. One of the most if you like, bitter disillusioned moments I had with regard to the communists was they called us in the British press back here, News Chronicle and one or two other places, the Daily Worker in particular, they said we had received Franco gold, Trotsky fascists, and that we had got Franco gold. Well, you see, I knew I had not received any gold or money or favours or anything at all. So I knew they were untruthful. Other people, without my experience, could possibly be forgiven for not knowing the truth about it. But I knew I had no gold, therefore I knew the accusation was false. So whatever other people might think about it, I was no Trotsky fascist.
Coming back to Andreas Nin,
yes.
I asked you when and where you came across
him. In Barcelona, in the PUM headquarters, and he was writing there for international connections, yes.
Did you speak to him?
Oh, yes. Ordinary sort of things, you know, like good day and that sort of thing, because he only spoke French.
And could you get any impression of him as a person?
Not really, except that he had a jolly sense of humour. He had a very loud laugh that he would laugh like anything, and people would look at each other as much as they thought, get him laughing, you know. But otherwise, no, not really. Pleasant, affable, you know, you might even say joyous. He was quite a good, enjoyed life, I would say.
You've talked about the Trotskyist label that's been put on PUM.
Yes.
Did there seem to be any sign of admiration for Trotsky or support for his ideas when, in your personal experience?
Not much. Usually, the people that I spoke to in the PUM about Trotsky were as much critical of Trotsky as they were the communists. No, I didn't find any open advocacy for Trotsky, perhaps the reverse. The general comment was, oh, there's not much difference between them, you know. Whether that's... I don't think... It might have seemed justified at the time, but I think since history has shown that Trotsky was much more sinned against than sinning as a man... As a movement, they've probably done their fair share of sinning, perhaps in order to redress the balance.
Can you tell me how it was that you came to leave Spain?
Yes. After the events of May Day, the telephone building occurrences, there was a change in atmosphere there. For example, we'd had to give our British passports in to the embassy because they weren't any help to us when you were moving around Spain. What mattered was a piece of paper with either a communist party, an anarchist party, or a trade union stamp on it to say you were a bona fide worker approved of by the particular group that issued the visa, perhaps is a fairer description of it, to enable you to travel internally. The passport was useless. In fact, I have known when Anthony Eden was the Foreign Secretary at the time, and he had signed the passport, and Eden had also signed the non-intervention pact, and a Spaniard has actually looked at my passport, read Eden, and he spat on the plain thing in as much as to say that's what we think of that, the bloody non-intervention crowd, you see. So your passport wasn't any good, but if you had a piece of paper signed by CNT, Phi, Souk, UGT, any one of these trade union political groups, you're in. That's fine.
Did you have one?
Oh, yes. Yes, we had one.
From?
I had a CNT one. That's right. It was issued by the CNT. Poom would issue them, but they preferred not to issue them. They were a bit snobbish about it. The party Marxist meant knowledge of Marxism, and they weren't giving them to anybody who might have read a Karl Marx pamphlet sort of sometime. They were a bit choosy, rather perhaps more like the Fabian Society. They expected a bit of ideological background if you got an identity card from them. But the CNT one, it was just the sort of pass that you might get from any transport group to enable you to go to and from the city. So there wasn't any particular specialisation required for that. I think George Orwell is on record as saying he didn't want a poom pass. I think he wrote to Bob Edwards and said that he'd be better off without one. And the CNT one was all right, which I think most of us had. But whether Bob had offered to get him one or not, but I remember this because during 1984, when they were celebrating the Orwell thing, this wasn't the BBC, ITV asked me if I would look in on their place up in town. What's it called? Grand something. Anyway, I agreed to go up, and they wanted my opinion of a Poom identity card, which they were going to show on television in connection with the 1984 production. Granada, isn't it?
Yes.
Granada. That was the crowd. And I said, yeah, that's all right, but in this particular Orwell case, it's not, because he's on record as saying he didn't have one. He wouldn't have one, and he didn't want one. So it's not very sensible to put one up. And so they said, oh, fair enough then, and the girl researcher was quite intelligent about this. She said, yeah, well, I don't think we should use it, which is right.
But the question I originally asked you was, how is it that you came to leave Spain? And you said that the atmosphere had changed.
Yes, that's right, and that led us on to identity cards. And then you had to have these identity cards to get around. But after the events of May, because of the fact that the CNT Phi were no longer in control, their visa, their passport, their identity card wasn't as useful in certain areas now, because the power had changed. So we were advised to get our British passports and use those in the future. And this is an indication of how things had changed. And we had to go and get our passports from the embassy to use, because now they were a bona fide and useful way of getting us around, whereas before they had been an obstacle. And now people no longer looked at Eden and spat as though it was something disreputable, but they would say, oh yes, a nice official looking bona fide document, carry on. So because that was the situation, it was thought that things would get more and more unpopular for us internationals. We would get viewed more and more